interviewing the leading private equity executives and unlocking the secrets of success. Welcome to the Private Equity Podcast with Alex Rawlings.
Welcome to the Raw Selection Private Equity Podcast, interviewing the leading private equity executives and unlocking the secrets of success. Joining us today, I'm hugely excited about, is Victor Vescovo, the founder of the private equity firm Inside Equity, retired US Navy intelligence officer, world record holder, undersea explorer, being the first person to reach the deepest points in every ocean across the world. And based on what I've found online and Googling, there's a lot more as well. So I'm super excited. But thank you very much for joining us, Victor, and sharing your industry insights and obviously a lot more today, hopefully.
Sure. Thank you for having me. And I was co-founder of my private equity firm along with Ted Bineski, who is my partner of 30 years. Just want to put that in there.
Absolutely. Well, there's my first mistake, but I appreciate you. appreciate you pointing that out. So there's a little bit of an intro there, but I know there's a lot more, Victor. But if you could give us a kind of 60, 90 second breakdown of yourself to give our listeners an understanding a bit more about yourself, please.
Sure. No worries. So I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas. So I'm a native Texan. Very proud of that. But I spent a lot of my career in management consulting and investment banking in my early years and made the transition to private equity about 20 years ago when I partnered with Ted Bineski to found Inside Equity, focused on mid-market industrial type firms. I spent 20 years as a reserve officer in the military, in the Navy. So I know a lot of their products. So I tend to have an aerospace and defense background, and that's the type of assets that I typically deal with, although I do a lot in electronics as well. And on my kind of side time, I was involved in high altitude mountaineering for about 20 or 30 years and was able to climb to a lot of different mountains, including Everest, and did a lot of extreme adventuring for quite some time. But about 3 or 4 years ago, I was curious if there was, you know, something more exotic to do in the oceans. And I was shocked to discover that no one had been to the bottom of 5 of the world's oceans. And one thing led to another. And I knew we had the technology that could allow for that to happen, but it required organization, quite a bit of capital, and the right team to actually construct kind of a third generation ultra deep diving submersible, which we did build. And then I also bought a support ship from the US Navy, refurbished it. And in the course of 10 months, we took it around the world and dove to the bottom of all 5 of the world's oceans, including repetitive dives to the bottom of Challenger Deep, the deepest point in the ocean. And I think we'll be coming out with a world record on that very soon.
Amazing. So I think the first burning question here is, okay, people haven't done that, but why did you decide that that was something you wanted to do, to go so deep into the oceans?
Well, as one great Englishman said, you know, maybe because it's there. You know, Sir Mallory asked why he climbed Everest. And I think there's just something that drives certain individuals, myself among them, that we just want to fill in the blank spaces on the map. We're always looking for some big challenge. We're just not content if we're, you know, sitting on a couch watching other people do it. We want to get out there and actually try and push us forward. It's kind of a burning compulsion that we have, for good or for ill. It can get us into a lot of trouble, particularly in mountain climbing. I've had a couple of bad accidents, but, you know, that never dissuaded me from wanting to go even further. And so this was a challenge that I thought humankind back then in the year 2016 had not yet achieved. And yet I thought, good gracious, this is something we should have done by now. We hadn't been to the bottom of 4 of our own world's oceans. I mean, surely that has to be done. And I just come from a culture and I guess a personality of, you know, if not me, who? And since I had the time and the ability and the finances to be able to do it, I thought it'd be a great adventure. And it has been. And not only that, but we've been able to do an extraordinary amount of science to contribute to the world as well, which I've been giving away as well.
Amazing. Amazing. So tell us, and I don't know, you've already mentioned, obviously, going to the deepest, 4 deepest oceans. You've already mentioned in brief there, obviously, climbing Everest. What drives you to do all of these explorations, and what are your kind of top ones that you're most proud of, or you've achieved the most with regards to your explorations?
Yeah, I had a wonderful conversation with our expedition doctor when we went to the Challenger Deep the first time, Dr. Glenn Singleman of Australia, and he conveyed how there is some research saying that, you know, part of our personalities are driven by genetics, and they believe that there might be a certain type of gene that you can have, I believe, from 1 to 11 copies. And the more copies of that gene you have, the more risk-taking you are, the more interested you are in doing novel things. And he said he was pretty convinced that himself and me have all 11 copies of that gene. And so there's a genetic component, but then there's also probably a social component, how I was raised. I was raised to explore and just go places on my bicycle. I was always curious what was over the next hill. And there are always those people in society that do that. I mean, England has an incredible history of some extraordinary explorers like, you know, Shackleton and others who, that was what they did. And that's what made them happy. So that was the real compulsion. And mountaineering was a great introduction to extreme adventuring, just because mountaineering, unlike deep ocean diving or some other endeavors, is utterly physically punishing. What you have to do to prepare your body just to go up to those altitudes and then survive a 2-month climb up Everest. And I didn't even do it on my first try. It took me 2 tries because I got frostbite on the first attempt. But going through that experience is just extraordinary for good and ill. The diving of the world's oceans was much more of a mental and technical and organizational challenge. So they were very different, but they rhymed in many ways. And there are also a lot of parallels to business and, frankly, military operations as well. They all have rhyming components to them that determine whether they succeed or fail.
Interesting, interesting. You mentioned there about risk. I appreciate this is a private equity podcast. I could probably speak all day about your explorations and everything there. But you talked a little bit about your genetic profile and the makeup there and the research being around that kind of risk-taking element. Now, in private equity management consulting, we tend to look at risk and try and, you know, reduce risk or identify where the risk is at and therefore prepare for it. So how have you managed to utilize that kind of genetic makeup of yourself, obviously, with the private equity world?
Well, it's kind of both. Risk is such an important concept. Risk is not a bad thing. Risk can also allow for the achievement of things that are outside the norm, like in these expeditions. You can't climb Everest without taking risk. The real trick, whether it's mountain climbing, diving into the deep oceans with a prototype submarine, or making a massive private equity investment, it's about mitigating those risks and trying to enhance the potential upsides, the beta, while kind of cutting the corner off the potential negative sides. And that goes not just into genetics, because genetics makes you predisposed to being willing to take those risks, but it's training and discipline and working with a good team that maybe you've assembled to help you mitigate those risks so that other people can see things that you do not and can adjust for factors that are unanticipated. A great example being, you know, COVID-19 and how that has affected business. A lot of people have been trained to deal with dynamic situations like that and actually take advantage of them and not just be a deer in the headlights. And there are similarities when you're climbing a mountain. If something bad happens, you can't just freeze in place and say, I want to go home. No, you've got to work the problem. And so many people in private equity that are good at what they do are experts at risk mitigation on the front end, like a good stuntman does with a dangerous stunt. But then they're also masters of adaptability and basically trying to make, you know, lemonade out of lemons when they are dealt a bad situation, or frankly, take advantage of it. And those are the real key differentiators I've seen in private equity are the people that can not only mitigate risk on the front end, but adapt to changing circumstances rapidly and effectively.
Okay. So that's a good trait. What's the kind of big mistakes you either see happening in private equity firms or equally in portfolio companies that you see come up maybe time and time again, or one of the bigger ones that you've seen?
There are several. In investing in general, there is a tendency for us to become emotionally involved in asset purchases or get committed or get our egos involved, where we'll hold on to bad situations longer than we should because we fear the downside. We're not willing to be real honest with ourselves, but that's why it's good to have partners as well. I think that's one key thing is you always have to be brutally honest with yourself about what is happening with investment and what can be done to improve them. The other is, frankly, hesitancy. It is human nature not to want to make hard decisions. In fact, I think a lot of us, particularly in operationally focused private equity, we make our livings making really hard decisions that most people don't want to do, involving disposing of poor divisions or replacing high-level personnel, not just one, but several or entire teams. And that's something that most people aren't trained to do and are uncomfortable doing because it's so easy just to go along to get along. But we get paid to make effective changes. And those are probably the two biggest things is just understanding truly what is happening and being honest about it. And second, you know, never really hesitating too much. We don't get paid to hesitate.
Okay, interesting. And what have you drawn, you know, with those mistakes? Clearly, that's something you're very, very aware of. What have you drawn both from your military career, but also your exploration and all of this kind of, if we put it down to kind of outdoor work, what have you drawn from that that's been related into private equity?
A big one is the concept that immediately came to mind is cutting your losses. Any great trader will tell you the same thing. If you go into an investment or a mountain climb or anything like that, and you did all this preparation and all this risk mitigation, and it is going sideways or even worse, you really should question everything that's happening. And maybe you should have built in an escape hatch to say, okay, I'm going to cut my losses. Let's go out and try again. You can always try again in most situations if you're careful. And mountain climbing, other things, you know, if you die, you can't. But in investing, if you really were that wrong, where immediately things just start going wrong, you really should try and mitigate your risk instead of throwing good money after bad. And I've been guilty of that as well, where you want to salvage a situation and your reputation, but that can be the wrong decision to make. So that's the first thing that came to mind.
Interesting. And I suppose that links into the fact that you, when you went for climb Everest, obviously you got frostbite. I'm going to take it that that was quite a big decision to turn around.
Yeah, that was probably the most painful decision I've ever personally made, because it takes about a year or more to train just to make an attempt on Everest and the expense involved, everything. And yeah, I got up halfway up the mountain and I just was careless and I didn't have quite the proper gear and I got frostbite on my fingers. And my guide said, you know, if you really wanted to force it, you could continue to go up, but you're not going to be able to use the ropes as effectively. You're increasing your risk that something really bad could happen and your hands aren't going to get any better. They could, in fact, get quite worse. So, you know, how much do you really want to keep all your tippies? And I said, you know what? It's just not worth it. You know, I'll take the hit now. I'll go back. I'll figure out what went wrong and I'll do it better next time. And that's exactly what happened. And 2 years later, I went back up and it was still extremely difficult, but I was better prepared mentally as well as with the right gear and equipment. I never got careless with my hands and I was able to summit.
What was it like that having known that you'd had that barrier the first time to then achieving that the second time? What was that like?
Well, it was helpful in a way because I knew what to expect. It wasn't a complete unknown anymore. I knew how psychologically punishing climbing that mountain could be, or frankly, how a bit frightening it is to go through the ice fall, this massive area that you have to go through where the blocks of ice are constantly moving and shifting. And, you know, there are avalanches, as people have seen, I'm sure, on YouTube and in news reports. So you're just better prepared overall to do that. And I'm sure that actually helped the success. Just, you know, as any bad investments that we make, hopefully you learn from them, and then that makes your next ones even better.
Absolutely. So looking at Inside Equity, what was it that drove you to set that up with your partner and build that business?
Well, I think anyone that's been involved in management consulting for quite some time, which he had been and I had been a little bit less so, but also in investment banking, those are advisory or transactional type activities, which are great. And some people are gifted at it and that's what they're born to do. But I think a lot of us want to be on the buy side. So we actually have control over the investments where we are actually making the decisions. We want to be in the act of making the decisions that guide companies and then bearing the fruits of those decisions. And so it wasn't hard at all to go from consulting to private equity because I was growing a little bit weary of just advising clients on what to do. And sometimes they would do it and sometimes they wouldn't, which was really frustrating when they wouldn't do the right answer because it was too hard or they just didn't like the decision emotionally, even though it was the correct thing. So it was really easy to go into the buy side and then, you know, being on the line sometimes. I've been interim CEO, I think, of three of our companies, and sometimes that was necessary. But that's something I often relished because then I was able to immediately impact the companies and hopefully get them on the right trajectory.
Interesting. And a big question I think everyone's probably asking is how on earth do you find the time to run your own firm, to do all these explorations, to be on the boards of companies, and do everything else that you've got to do within your general day-to-day life? Where are you finding the time for this, Victor?
I've never been married and I don't have kids. I have to confess that that's part of the issue. And I think that, you know, I say it a little bit flippantly, but it's true. I mean, one has priorities in life. You can't do everything, but you do have to prioritize in your life what is important for you. And, you know, given my personality in my 20s and frankly in my 30s, my priorities were my career, both in the civilian world in finance and in the military. And then I really wanted to go out into the world and explore and climb mountains. And when it came time to decide whether to do those activities or make a stronger commitment to the person that I was with, unfortunately, I chose the former, much to the dismay of the latter, and I never quite found the right person that would put up with me. So there you go.
Well, disappearing to go down to the bottom of the oceans and climbing to the tallest mountains. You've literally
there was a key moment after 9/11 where I was in the reserve military and I was, you know, living with a young lady, and 9/11 happened. And I got a call that night because I actually used to live and work in the Middle East and I speak Arabic reasonably well. And, you know, they called me up immediately. And it turned out, you know, they told me, yeah, you're going to go away for at least a year, maybe more. And I told her that. And she said, I just can't do that, you know. And so that was it. So, you know, in about 6 days after 9/11, I went from having a nice, stable life in San Francisco to .com, living with someone with my dogs. 6 days later, I was in a vault in Pearl Harbor, you know, working targeting folders for Afghanistan. I mean, welcome to my life. It was wild.
Absolutely. What was it like being in the military, especially during those, you know, turbulent times, to say the least?
Oh, that was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my life, actually, was being able to join the military as an intelligence officer, given my background. And I was involved in multiple conflicts. I was significantly involved in the Kosovo War in 1999 when that occurred, because I was trained primarily as a targeting officer and later as a counterterrorism officer. But after 9/11, it was such a wonderful situation for me to be in, because like so many people, we wanted to do something. We wanted to contribute and, you know, help our country in this very dark time. And I was able to do so. I mean, they got me on a plane and I was actually working problems of how to safeguard the country for the next year and a half. And that was incredibly rewarding. And some of the best people I've ever met in my life who have an incredible sense of patriotism, self-sacrifice, and are just darn good at what they do have been in the military. So it was a great experience.
Interesting. So, and looking at private equity, if we've got somebody listening that's maybe working their way up in a firm right now, as in actually within a private equity business, what advice would you give to them to be able to progress through? There's always the the perceived golden egg of being a partner within an organization. What advice would you give somebody who's progressing with their career and has those ambitions to get to the top of the firm?
Be correct. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't mean to put it too lightly, but it's like working in a hedge fund or a private equity firm, et cetera. It's a meritocracy and success is rewarded. You make partner by making the right calls. And I've had more than a few people come through the doors of Inside Equity who were brilliant, who worked hard, but they just didn't make the right calls. There was something in their own nature or how they analyzed information where they didn't see the right things. And then there were other people that they just always seemed to make the right calls or get the things done that need to get done. And they also are smart and work hard. So that's what it just comes down to. And if there's any suggestion I can make is try as best you can to look at all the angles. Do not get so deal hungry that you turn a blind eye to serious issues with the deal. And frankly, the best deals you do are the ones where you see a major problem and you avoid it, even at the last minute. And we have absolutely done that. And I respect the hell out of people that can raise their hand up, even at the 11th hour, saying, wait a second, we discovered this, this, and this. This is a big new risk. Maybe we shouldn't do this deal, or we should cut the price to mitigate it. That kind of thing. That's essential. And the people that have made the biggest mistakes in my career in private equity have been people that have been so hungry for a deal. They just want to get that deal done so they can, you know, put that skin up on the wall. They've turned out to be our worst deals. And once you get into a bad deal, it's really hard to salvage them. So don't be so deal hungry to get that skin on the wall that you blind yourself to what really is a bad deal.
Well, that comes down to, you know, decision-making process and doing it for the right reasons. Very interesting. Yep. So I'm interested at clearly being in an executive search about top performers. I'm going to ask you about that in a moment. But one thing I would be really interested in hearing about is actual leadership, because you've seen leadership from leading a private equity firm. You've seen it from a military perspective, where I think there's definitely a perception that real, you know, the top end of leadership is in this kind of scenarios where obviously, you know, most people don't want to experience or can't even fathom that kind of experience. And then you've seen, you know, life and death situations going up to the top of Everest, but also, you know, going far deep into the depths of the earth. What what do you regard, or what's your kind of interpretation of what makes a really good leader?
Let's start it with the other way. It's easier to actually say what makes a bad leader, because you see that much more easily, and then I can segue into what makes a good one. But what makes so many bad leaders are people that really don't know the job of what their own people do. They can't, you know, work a spreadsheet, and they try and cover it up in many respects with bravado, because I think deep down they're insecure. Mm-hmm. People that are very domineering and command and control, it stuns me how often they end up in the senior leaders of companies. That doesn't work very well. So to segue into what does work, I think it's important that you're just very, very competent. You don't have to be supremely confident in everything that a company does, but you need to have a very strong skill set in at least one major discipline, operations or finance or even HR or product development or something like that. You need to be really good. If you're not really, really good in at least one or two things, you're not going to get the respect that you need to lead other people. And that's when people lapse into just being, well, do as I say, because I'm in charge. No one respects that. And if people don't respect you, they're not going to put in the extra effort to do a good job. And then the second is you need to treat people like human beings. I mean, you can be very tough, but you also need to acknowledge what they need in their lives, for their families, et cetera. And for heaven's sake, you know, if people have issues in their performance, never castigate people in public. I see that all the time, and it's one of the worst mistakes you can possibly make. There's an old rule in the military: you criticize in private and you praise in public. And that's the right way to manage people. And yet so many people do it the opposite, which just mystifies me. So I think those are some of the key leadership issues. And then frankly, I'll quote Star Trek. One of my favorite quotes of all time came from Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek. He said, "When you're in command, command." And it goes the same for military as well as leaders in companies, which is if you're in charge, your job is to make the hard calls. That's what you get paid for. Don't dither too much. Don't overanalyze. Don't slough it off on somebody else. Make the decision with the best information you have and live with it. And if it's wrong, admit that it's wrong and do something else. But don't, you know, weave around and try and avoid responsibility. People respect people that make tough calls and then live by those decisions for good or for ill. They'll follow those people.
Excellent. And I'm sure there's going to be some similarities here, but what do you regard as the makeup of a top performer?
Makeup of a top performer, there are several things. One, they have to enjoy what they're doing. You can tell really quickly if someone enjoys what they're doing and if they don't. If they enjoy it, they're going to work really hard at it because they like doing it. And if they work really hard at it over a long period of time, they're going to be damn good at it. So that's key. You don't want people that are frustrated with their job or don't really like it. They're never going to be an A performer, really. So there's that. You have to have people that really do want to do the work. So many people, you know, they just want to put in the 9-to-5 or they want to do just enough, et cetera. And they can do a good job in an organization and you do need people like that, but they're not going to be your A performance. You have to put in the work. And in my own career, I think over the last several decades, I've seen a greater and greater decrease in the willingness of people to do that. I think maybe because there are just so many distractions. There are so many things you can do online or offline or what have you. And there is still commitment, but not as much. I look at organizations like SpaceX, where you have Elon Musk, you know, the leader, who's a guy who who's a multi-billionaire, and yet he has a cot in his office because he works so much, he'll just sleep in the office. That's a level of commitment and intelligence that goes along with it that is the hallmark of a strong performer. And the other part is you just have to be willing to listen to other people. You know, the talk to listen ratio, you really should watch that, because you don't learn anything by talking yourself. You learn by listening to other people's opinions. And maybe they're wrong, but it's really good to get out that perspective to incorporate into your own viewpoint. But then again, when it comes down to making a decision, you've taken in your input, make the call, move forward. Last comment I'll make, if there's one thing that I've seen underappreciated the most in business in my last 30 years, it's speed. Speed of execution, speed of decision-making, speed of hiring, everything. If you just increase that cycle time, you're going to have a more effective organization. And yes, you'll make maybe mistakes. You're going to make them anyway, even if you go slowly. I've seen some of the worst mistakes ever made by people that deliberated too slowly as well. Look at government. So speed of execution is always valued, and try and work that way.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely something I got given feedback in early in my career. Two ears, one mouth, used in that order.
In that proportion, and,
You learn more from others than you could ever learn from your own self, because you already know that information. So, yeah, absolutely. So what do you love about the private equity industry, Victor? You talked about the passion and wanting to love your industry. So what do you love about it? And equally, if hate's too much of a strong word, what do you dislike about it?
What I like about private equity is the fact that you are having direct impact on these companies. You're like a ship on the fantail. You're guiding them. And you can be the difference between them succeeding and a lot of people, the organization succeeding and achieving their own personal goals financially or career-wise and not. So that's incredibly rewarding when you have a big success story where you have a company that's grown by two or three or four times and you've allowed people to make more money than they ever thought they could and have professional achievements that they never thought they could have. That's extremely rewarding, especially in an area that, frankly, like defense and aerospace, I read trade magazines just because I like doing it. And so being able to do all that in an industry that you really just enjoy the products and the interactions is great. I guess things that I really hate about private equity, the toughest part is actually having to say goodbye, right? It's tough to work 3, 4, 5 years, build up a management team, build a good strategy, getting a company to firing on all the cylinders, and then you're forced more or less to sell them because you have a time limit on the private equity funds. I also think that it can be very difficult, explaining to investors that, yes, sometimes you're not going to have good investments. I think there's an unrealistic expectation on the part of investors that, you know, there are winners and there are losers, but it's about the batting average that really matters. And it always strikes me as so difficult how it seems like we spend 90% of our time speaking with our LPs about our poor performing investments as opposed to our good ones, when it's really the good ones that really matter that more than compensate for any of the small ones. But I guess, you know, that's just how they're wired. So there are some frustrations of private equity as well, but it certainly affords many more opportunities and ability to do great things than many other careers.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because I made that link with regards to any LP focusing on what's kind of going wrong. We do exactly the same with people within our within our businesses, where we focus on the poor performance rather than really focusing on how do we get even more performance and how do we help X person to perform even better. We tend to lay our focus on the wrong areas within business.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, cutting your losses on the losers is very important as well in investing. But this goes into another military analogy. There's a great tale about military theory, especially the old Soviet Union did this, and they would give a problem to their staff officers. If they had three advances and one wasn't going well, one was stalled, and one was succeeding, where do you send your reinforcements? And there was only one answer in their military doctrine, which was you always, always, always send everything to the one guy who's succeeding. Reinforce success, ignore everything else. And that's hard for people to do. Instead, they're going to want to shore up their bad performance so they look better, you know, and oh, the guy that's doing well, okay, he'll be fine on his own. That's the opposite. You will make money in life, you'll achieve military victories, you'll do the best you can by reinforcing success to the maximum extent possible. And it kind of makes sense intellectually, right? Because hey, something is working there, give it more. And yet we actually don't so many times.
I agree. I completely agree. And I think, you know, if I'm reflecting back on some of the decisions even that I make with things, and you're like, yeah, you know, should have just focused on what was going really well rather than trying to fight with everything that maybe wasn't. But I think maybe there's a bit of human nature in there that makes you kind of focus on that bad. I suppose I was listening to a podcast on it actually about that, we're genetically wired to try and avoid pain and get away from that. So if there's a problem, we're naturally there to solve it. And that's what we're looking to do. Whereas that kind of pleasure side, if you want to break it down to such a simplistic perspective, it definitely sits on there. But, you know, focusing more on what's going really well is very sound advice.
It's funny. I've observed that achieving success is in a constant vicious battle with human nature. Sometimes we just can't get out of our own way when success presents itself.
Well, self-sabotage, I think, is a major thing that plays into everyone's life, as we all kind of have a thermostat. And as soon as we go over that thermostat, we go reset to wherever we were before. And if we go below it, we reset. And it's about changing those, certainly changing those boundaries. So what are your influences? What do you read? What do you watch? What do you listen to? You obviously mentioned you read a lot about the A&D industry. But where do you get your kind of influences from?
Oh, it's tough. I've always been a big reader, so I love reading nonfiction, but science fiction is also something I've read since I was a small boy, and that's something that always kind of sparks the imagination, but also has a technical bent. So that's kind of what I read for pleasure. But the other one is history. I adore history. And I think the old expression, you know, people, you know, it's the not bright people that do not learn from their mistakes. Smart people learn from their mistakes. The true geniuses learn from the mistakes of other people. And as I've told people that work for me and others, you know, virtually every mistake that could possibly be made by a human has been made already in history. You just have to ferret out through the histories what they did, and then maybe you could avoid it. And so I'm a big fan, particularly of military history, because in military history, the stakes are as high as they can possibly go. And you have some incredibly powerful personalities and lots of chaos. You know, nothing can be worse than war. So reading military history is about what worked, what didn't work. And all that has proven extremely valuable. So on a plane, if you ever run into me, odds are I'll probably have a military history book of some kind in my bag that I'm reading on a flight.
Interesting. And who would you regard as one of the, one of the most like famous in your world or perspective or most infamous, maybe military leaders?
Napoleon. He is by far, I think, the most interesting. I mean, Julius Caesar was an extraordinary general, as was Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, all those. Napoleon was fascinating because I think there are a lot of lessons to learn, not just about how revolutionary he was in terms of military tactics. He was the first guy to conquer Europe, you know, basically. But his personnel management is widely not viewed. And yet the creation of the military that he did with the martial system, with very different personalities and training them and using them to the best of their abilities and swapping them out, how he managed his organization was very similar to how, you know, a Fortune 100 CEO manages his divisions and or her divisions and their personnel. And just reading the human side of what he did and also the incredible administrative capability that he had was just extraordinary. So he was an incredibly well-rounded individual that did extraordinary things. And of course, what ended up, you know, causing him to go into exile on the island was he got overambitious. You know, he thought after conquering almost all of Europe, well, I can do anything. And he made the mistake of invading Spain and Russia. And we all know how that turned out. So he had his flaws as well. He had great capabilities and great flaws. And it's just a great human story about what can make us great and what can make us terrible. And also how he related to people and how he inspired them, how he managed them, and how he led them in battle.
So talking about flaws, have you ever been blindsided? And if so, what did you learn from it?
Oh, goodness gracious. Yes, I've been blindsided more than a few times. If I have one or two failings, one is that, you know, there's a very fine line between being a good risk taker and being a little bit reckless. So I have certainly pushed beyond the boundaries of where I was operating with good information and good risk mitigation and ended up in a very, very bad situation. One has to know oneself well enough to know when you're now being reckless and not just taking a good mitigated risk. So there's that. And then, of course, I can be just as much a victim as anyone in the investing side of investing in things that I personally like, even though they may not be a great investment, or I turn a blind eye to weaknesses in them. And you just have to be very careful against those.
Absolutely. And what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self, Victor?
Oh, my 20-year-old self. I was so stupid then. I would say be patient and plan, but know that no plan survives contact with reality. Always be trying to achieve something in, you know, 2, 5, or 7 years, but know deep down that it's not going to turn out that way. And that's okay. You have no idea what opportunities are going to come across, and say yes to things. Don't be too conservative or be too concerned about the near-term benefit of something. Take the risk, and if it doesn't turn out well, especially if you're in your 20s, it's okay. you know, people don't hold it against you. You know, if you took some risks in your 20s and it didn't work out, they'll ask you, what did you learn from them? And really try and learn those lessons. And then you can hopefully apply them when the score really starts getting written in ink in your 30s and 40s.
Absolutely. I think if anyone's learned anything from this, you're, I think you said 13 genes that you've got in there with regards to risk taking. But it's amazing. You know, we talk about even the brand of Raw Selection is that de-risking element. We think of financial services as being really risk adverse. I think it's amazing that you talk about, you know, taking that opportunity because we all do it. You know, me certainly included. I'm heavy. I mean, Europeans tend to be heavy political correctness, heavy risk take, heavy risk adverse. And we kind of just, we need to know every bit of out of every information. And then maybe that opportunity has already passed us by. But yeah, certainly I think it's, you know, take those opportunities and go after them immediately. So that's definitely been incredibly insightful for myself, Victor. I could literally talk to you all day, but there's so many questions that could come out here. But if somebody did want to reach out to you, and hopefully you won't get bombarded after this, Victor, but if somebody did want to reach out, what would be the best way of them kind of getting in touch with you if they had a certain question or something to explore?
Well, I mean, Inside Equity has a website, insideequity.com, and I'm on the team page there, and I'm perfectly accessible through my corporate portal. So by all means, just drop me an email and happy to assist if I can.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Victor. I really appreciate your insight. It's been absolutely fascinating. There's a million and one questions I could ask you also, but equally, I'm sure you've got other things to be doing with the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
As always, thank you for joining us for our listeners. And of course, should you ever need support with private equity professionals for your firm or portfolio executives within your portfolio companies, please do reach out to me at Raw Selection. But till the next time, keep smashing it and all the best.
Thank you for listening to the Private Equity Podcast on www.raw-selection.com.